I'm Alex Beam, sitting in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The Good War, fought by the greatest generation, the Band of Brothers, that's the familiar storyline. Is it no accident, perhaps, that the modern hagiographers of World War II, Tom Brokaw, Tom Hanks, and Steven Spielberg, never fought in it? The writer and scholar Paul Fussell did fight in World War II, in the U.S. infantry that swept, at times actually stumbled, across France and Belgium into the Third Reich. Fussell was 18 when he enlisted in 1943, and within months, he was leading men, many of them teenagers just like himself, into combat in what he calls the Boys' Crusade. His new book of the same name is a cold-eyed look at the final campaign of World War II, the American Army's post-D-Day slog into the heart of Hitler's Germany. Fussell sees the war whole. He tells of the mass desertions, the cowardice, the atrocities committed by both Americans and Germans in the waning months of the conflict. Fussell sees acts of heroism, too, and he isn't shy about recounting them. The key reason for fighting, Fussell writes, became apparent only at the very end, when the American armies first saw Hitler's death camps. Quote, hardly any boy infantryman started his career as a moralist. But after the camps, a moral attitude was rampant, and there was no disagreement on the main point. Connection listeners, is America still in love with the myth of the good war? The nation's involvement is often depicted as noble, emotionally uncomplicated, and filled with moral purpose. Is that how you understand it or experienced it? And how do our memories and myths about war's past shape our sense of America's role in the world? You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-423-8255. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. My guest this hour is Paul Fussell. He's the author of the new book, The Boys' Crusade, The American Infantry in Northwestern Europe, 1944 to 1945. Paul Fussell, thank you for being with us.
Not at all. I'm happy to be here.
Great. You obviously had a purpose in writing this specific book about World War II. Can you share that with us?
Yes. The purpose was, you've already suggested it, the purpose was to scatter a little tiny bit of truth over the sentimentalities being vended by Steve Ambrose, the late Steve Ambrose, who was a friend of mine, and, of course, Tom Brokaw, the sweetheart from South Dakota, who apparently never met somebody he didn't like and who likes everything and who's a very bad judge, actually, to infantry warfare, which is about not liking anything and killing off as fast as possible the worst offenders against things, that is, the enemy. Your point is good. Whoever made it, that some acquaintance with actual warfare ought to be a legal requirement for anybody writing about war or giving his views about it, because it is otherwise unthinkable to ordinary people what being an infantryman and being an infantryman for many months was actually like. People also forget, and I don't think it is dealt with properly by either Steve Ambrose or Tom Brokaw, that to get the American foot army over into Europe, we had to draft them all. They didn't want to serve. They were all conscripts, many of them extremely bitter about having their lives interrupted and perhaps being killed. And they were draftees. And you never get that impression from either Brokaw or Ambrose that they were not all gung-ho volunteers and wonderful Boy Scouts and so on, anxious to do their bit. No, it was very hard to get them moving at all at any moment. So it was to counter those two errors in optimistic America that I wrote the book.
I've read your book, and there's not a simple answer to the next question, but talk to us about morale as a condition in the infantry in all of its complexity.
That's a very good question, and I really don't know the answer. It depended on who was leading a unit, of what size it was, and where the boys came from. Did they come from Texas, or did they come from New Hampshire? the great differences in character between those two, production areas of American young people. Morale was crucial because if you give an order and nobody obeys it, you lose the war. So it is essential that the troops' morale be kept up, that they believe in what they're doing, even if what they're doing is conquering the next hill that they're facing or crossing the next streamlet or river that they must cross. They've got to be kept believing in what they're doing, and what they're doing is very seldom serving democratic purposes or doing what the people at home would like to think they were doing. What they were doing was not disgracing themselves in front of their friends who were next to them in the fighting. And consequently, everybody's morale was extremely important. I kept mine up by thinking and by telling my troops that the war couldn't last forever, that if we stick with it and do what we're supposed to do, we will probably or even perhaps survive. And that sort of half-optimistic morale item carried me through and carried most of my men through also.
You have a statistic in the book which is, it's not one that you see oft repeated in World War II histories. And again, I don't want to mischaracterize the essence of your book, but I had not before encountered the number of 19,000 American desertions in the European theater, I think possibly just for 2 years. And you then write that only 9,000 of these troops were found and disciplined. And in the context of morale, I did not serve in World War II, of course. That seems like a pretty big number.
It is a big number, and this is why I tend to smile lewdly when somebody uses the phrase "the greatest generation." It was not the greatest generation. It was a slice of America as it actually is. And it's too bad. And everybody in the Army knew about these desertions and did their best to prevent or reverse them. But there were these desertions, and most of them, as I've indicated, were in aid of helping the black market in Paris survive. The black market in Paris was something never mentioned in public during the war, and it never got any publicity until the war was well over. But there was a vast traffic in stolen American goods of all kinds, carried on by deserters and former American soldiers, who would steal cheese, and they would steal toilet paper, and they would steal army uniforms, and they would steal firearms, and anything saleable from American service corps and so forth, and would bring it to Paris to sell at very high volumes. There's a book, by the way, to be written, which nobody's thought of yet, about what happened to these deserters who married French girls, had French families, and stayed there and are still there, aged 80. They're still there running businesses and so on, and it's been much too late to try to pursue them and prosecute them.
Yeah.
That is one, a bit of evidence about the greatest generation. Let's keep it in mind.
I'm going to ask you what happened to the missing 10,000. I was also curious, I mean, did you interact with people who deserted and did?
No.
You never did?
No, because they deserted from my positions on the front line.
But some got caught and came back, forcibly returned.
They never came back. No. If they were caught, they were taken away and probably ended up in Leavenworth Prison in Kansas. I never saw any of them again. In fact, I had very few desertions in my unit. There were very few, and there were also very few self-inflicted wounds. I don't know why, but I was in a place where my troops were not in such agonizing danger all the time as to produce both behaviors. Important to realize that the deserters that were discovered and arrested and punished, that took place well away from the front line. And I never got off the front line for about 4 months. I was there all the time.
I
could have added in the book the utter absence of women where we were, the utter absence of anything worth stealing and committing any kind of normal crime. We lived in the ground like trolls and hoped that the next shell would not fall too near us to do damage.
You briefly allude in the book to the difference between German and American infantry, and I think it's you write, but it's pretty widely known, I think, that if the German infantry, or certainly if a Soviet infantryman deserted his division, he'd be shot.
Yes.
What is that? I mean, is that good or bad? What does that tell us about the situation in which you
fought?
Well,
I think it's bad in the late 20th century. In the 17th or 18th century, it would make some sense, and well, indeed, into the 19th. But not in modern times, when there's a great dispute about the decency of capital punishment for appalling criminals and so on, mass murderers and so on. That's what I would say about it. The German solution to desertion, that is shooting the deserter as soon as possible, as I said in the book, differed so much from the American solution to it, which was to have a sergeant in each small unit whose job was to govern the rear of the unit and to make certain that no kid got away, or at least dissuaded him from running, that the difference was one of the things that the war seemed to us to be about. That is, the sort of totalitarian treatment of individuals among the Germans and the more, shall we say, the word democratic is not bad odor, but the more humane and civilized and safe way of dealing with deserters that we had. You arrest them, you send them back for a little court-martial, you send them to a prison for a little prison sentence, and you try to redeem them and bring them back to the line. But since I never had any deserters that I was aware of, I never had any returnees either.
Paul Fussell, we're coming up on a break. You mentioned that critical difference, in a sense, between the organization of the two countries, Germany and the United States. Would it be fair or ludicrously sort of naive to think that that was a – I mean, did that animate the men in your division, for instance, fighting for that cause?
Yeah, very much. It wasn't the cause. It was the Germans whom we hated. We hated the enemy, and that was absolutely necessary if we were going to do our job. And we didn't know why we hated them exactly, except that they picked on the weak and the poor. They killed Jews. They required total patriotic attentiveness on the part of the soldiers and so on. And that they were therefore our enemy.
Paul Fussell, we're coming up on a break. Our guest is Paul Fussell, the author of The Boys' Crusade. He's a World War II historian and book critic. We're talking about World War II this hour, how it's depicted, how it's written about, and how it's remembered. Connection listeners, do you think America is still in love with the myth of the good war and the greatest generation? How do our memories and myths about wars shape our sense of America's role in the world? You can join our conversation with Paul Fussell by calling 1-800-423-8255. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Talk. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. I'm Alex Beam, sitting in for Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Our guest this hour is Paul Fussell, World War II historian, veteran, and book critic. His new book is called The Boys' Crusade: The American Infantry in Northwestern Europe, 1944 to 1945. We're talking about the Great War this hour, how it's depicted in history, and how it's remembered. You can join our conversation if you want to think about the question of the greatest generation. Are we still in love with the myth of the good war? How do our memories and our myths about the past wars we've been engaged in shape our sense of the current wars that we're in and America's role in the world? You can join the conversation here by calling 1-800-423-8255. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. Paul Fussell is with us. Paul, you began delineating the difference which of course was pretty stark between Adolf Hitler's Third Reich and Franklin Roosevelt's United States. Certainly a powerful moment in your book, and you use it well and you describe it well, is when the GIs come across the death camps. And I wonder if you can explain to us how you use that for context.
Well, the arrival of, it was generally General Patton's troops at the death camps, and the first was Ohrdruf, which is now almost forgotten, and those work death camps in Bavaria. The troops simply went wild with the impulse, I think, not to do justice, but to torture and to murder the guards who had treated these weak people so badly. And consequently, none of this was ever reported either. The Jews began by beating up the guards whenever they could, and then called for assistance on the Americans who were arriving with firearms, who then lined up the guards, 100 and so on wide, and simply machine gunned them all without trial, without questions about their duties, without admissions of what they had done, and so forth. And that was a very profound moment, because it indicated to many of the soldiers who had had doubts before about the necessity of what they were engaged in, it convinced them that they now knew the point of the whole war. It was to wipe out National Socialism. That is, it was to wipe out the pseudo-religion of Hitler and his henchmen.
I liked in your book, on the very first page, you mention Dwight Eisenhower, and you kind of use him as a facsimile for really the American boy, the American Kansas boy. And then you tell us things at the end about Eisenhower's attitude evolving, shall we say, towards the Third Reich that are quite startling.
Yes, it is. And I did that intentionally because I wanted to see how appallingly bad the Germans were that they could force even Eisenhower, the sweet youth from Abilene, Kansas, force him to wish for the death of the entire German general staff, which consisted of 3,500 high officers. He actually wanted to, and this was his word, exterminate them, a word which hitherto had been in the possession largely of the Nazis when they talked about the punishments appropriate for their victims. I put that in there to indicate how awful the war really was, that it could turn a kid like Eisenhower, who in his boyhood, was fond of basketball and didn't mind going to church and so on, turn Eisenhower into a person holding comfortably such brutal ideas of justice and punishment. Most people didn't know that, or they forgot it.
I certainly, and you introduced the dramatic detail. I think he sends Bettel Smith, right, to take the surrender. He refuses essentially to even be in the room.
Exactly.
With his opposite numbers from the Third Reich.
Yes.
I'm going to interrupt you, as it were, Paul Fussell. I'm going to read a wonderful piece of prose that you wrote yourself. It's from your book, Doing Battle.
Yes.
And I believe you're writing this from a hospital bed. I think you were wounded and in a hospital bed when so-called VE Day, or Victory in Europe Day. And here's what you wrote. You wrote, "When VE Day was announced, I did celebrate by consuming a can of warm beer I'd been saving, but there was no pleasure in it. The reason is suggested by Kay Summersby, Eisenhower's British girlfriend. She said of the end of the German war, quote, 'No one laughed. No one smiled. It was all over. We had won, but victory was not like anything. It was not anything like I thought it would be. There was a dull bitterness about it. So many deaths, so much destruction, and everybody was very, very tired.'" Paul Fussell goes on to write, "One should notice there the absolute absence of anything like the ideological satisfaction non-combatants and promoters of the notion of, quote, the good war, unquote, would expect. No expression of righteous joy that Nazism had been destroyed or that the United States had been glorified in victory, our dead avenged. When the German war ended, a moment one might think an appropriate occasion for wild celebrations, the troops and those intimate with the mess that was now Europe seemed to agree with the British poet John Pudney that, quote, the less said, the better. That's a pretty darn bleak moment of release.
It was indeed, but that's exactly what happened. That was the way it was. The desire of the troops, the minute the war was over, was to get home as fast as possible and to forget about the ribbons you wore indicating the medals you'd won, to forget about your military rank that you began as a private and ended as a captain, all of that junk. They kicked under the rug and came home as fast as they could. And most of them forgot the war as soon as they could because it was so disgusting to think of and to remember.
Paul Fussell, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I think that's the reason why it's taken so many memoirs of the war, and they inundate me with their books, which are wonderful. I read them all. It took them so long to write about the war, almost between 50 and 60 years before they could awaken themselves again to the reality that they'd been through. It was so disgusting. And to write it down and try to get other people to understand it. It took a long time. Nobody was proud of what he'd done. Nobody was delighted by anything except that his life was saved.
We want to bring a caller into the conversation. Paul and other listeners can join us by calling 1-800-423-8255. Our phone number is 1-800-423-TALK. Robert's joining us from Dalzell, South Carolina.
Hello.
Hi, Robert.
Hello, Robert.
Hi, Mr. Fussell. First of all, I believe I am so honored to speak to you. You are the author of The Great War in Modern Memory, if I'm not correct.
I am indeed, but that was about the First World War, and it was about Great Britain. So it's a different world.
Yes, sir, I know, but I have my well-thumbed and tabbed copy in front of me. I found this to be an eye-opener about the war, the First World War. I just wanted to say that I agree with you. Something has bothered me as I have watched the Brokaw Greatest Generation thing grow and some things that I've seen in the American Legion and veterans organizations which I belong to, that initially the veterans didn't glorify a talk about World War II for years, as I was just a child at the time, and my father is a veteran. But as time has gone on in the last decade or so, there seems to be something else going on, like a myth that is putting a veneer on this thing that I think is something that's just not right. And that's the impression I'm getting.
Yeah, I think what you say is absolutely right, and I join you in that sentiment. By the way, I am a member of the Disabled American Veterans, which is the only veterans association I'm in. And I'm in for obvious reasons.
Yes.
What has happened to create the current jollification of the war? I don't know. It may be that a totally new generation of sensitive and imaginative readers have developed, and the kind of narrative that they demand requires the kind of optimism and pleasantness that we have not had available for some time. That's the only answer I can suggest to your very intelligent question.
Robert, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Paul Fussell, it's hard to, I remember, there's a famous biography of John Ford, who, as you probably know, made propaganda movies during World War II. And, you know, the biography is called Print the Legend, which I think is a line from The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. And how do you comment on in a sense our enduring lust legend over the reality?
Yeah, the legend is entirely a possession of popular culture. I still believe there's a vast chasm opened up between popular culture and real culture. Real culture makes you think. real culture has plenty of room for the tragic. Popular culture, no. And therefore, since the history of this country has largely been in the hands of those who perform popular culture, it has turned into a highly optimistic and cheerful construction.
Can I ask you about... Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
I just want to ask you about military history, because you use a lot of official military history.
Yeah, yeah.
And as you know, our country spends a great deal of money. There's a lot of historians in the Pentagon. Perhaps people aren't so aware of it.
Yes.
And yet, it's a slightly imperfect product, is it not?
No, not really if it's any good. It's absolutely objective and wonderful. Almost all the material I got about desertions, self-inflicted wounds, cowardice, and so on, come directly from American military history, written at the Pentagon or at the Army War College or something like that. They're not in the business of whitewashing anything, because they know they have the kind of readers who will understand what they say, even if it's not cheerful. The thing about popular culture is it has to be cheerful. It's interesting that the greatest play that came out of the Second World War was South Pacific. Now, if you believe that that had any relation whatever to the war, you are unreachable by the truth when it's brought to you by people that know something.
Well, people of my generation know, of course, the only successful television show to come out of World War II was Hogan's Heroes, that you may or may not
yes.
be, you know, purports to be a comedy that takes place in a prisoner of war camp. Go ahead.
Go ahead. I always hated Hogan's Heroes for that reason. Every time I saw it, I tried to calculate the number of minds that were being corrupted by watching that garbage.
We're going to bring in a caller to our conversation. Mike is phoning us from Wake Forest, North Carolina.
Hi there. I was wondering if Mr. Fussell had any comments concerning the effects of USO shows. I know that if I was in a situation like that, it would at the very least cause me to become extremely melancholy, and at the worst, might even drive me mad that, this back home reality was being put in front of me, knowing that I was going to go back to the hell he's been discussing.
I'm not certain I understand the question. Can you say again the thing that annoys you?
But, you know, like the USO shows, how they came and gave you a small break, but then you had to go right back to what you were doing before.
All right, well, I'll tell you a secret about the USO shows. I was for months on the front line, and I never once saw them, not once. I never once heard of them until I got back home after the war was over. A lot of soldiers saw them, but they weren't really soldiers. They were cooks and bakers. They were administrative assistants. They were stenographers. They were typists and so on. But the real fighting men almost never saw that kind of thing. It was too dangerous to bring Bing Crosby up, you know, within rifle range of the enemy, not to mention Marlene Dietrich and so on. And they did honorable service. This is one thing that always made me a little bit skeptical about the grandeur of Bob Hope, who performed in very, very safe places. And his problem was really, you know, primitive living conditions and so on. But he never risked his life the way the rest of us had to.
Mike, what was your take? Did the USO play a role in your life?
Well, that's just that I've never been in combat, and that's why I would have to project what my effects might be. But it's right up there, I think, with seeing the bugle and drum corps from the Revolutionary War outselling new cars on Memorial Day. It seems like it's just the statute of limitations for honoring war veterans is 100 years.
Yeah, well put, Mike. Thank you.
Michael, thank you for your call. My recollection, Paul Fussell, reading your book is that I've been wrong before, but that there were some incidents that did not appear in official military histories. You describe the so-called, you know, the Great Turkey Shoot, which, someone of my age looks pretty much like a My Lai massacre type event. Isn't in official history. It certainly isn't any kind of history that anyone's bragging about. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's not an official history because I got it from the word of mouth of a soldier who was there and telling me about it some 40 years later. And so, I don't think it belongs in real serious history because there's no documentary evidence of it. I believed it because I knew the people who did it. And I knew that nobody would believe they did it, and so on. And I stuck it in for that reason.
Can you just briefly describe the scene to us?
I wasn't there. You see, I was in a hospital suffering from wounds when this took place, and somebody told me about it when I came out of the hospital, that a number, I would say maybe a dozen German soldiers who were kids like us, had been caught, and we put them in a big shell crater to keep them together for a while. And the troops gradually assembled, who were very angry because their friends had just been killed by German machine guns and so on. Those people came and used their rifles to kill all these kids. Knowing what I know about the ethic of the front line, I found that not at all difficult to believe. That sort of thing happened, if not all the time, at least often enough to be a conspicuous mark of infantry warfare.
Okay, Paul Fussell, please stay with us. We'll be back for one more segment. Connection listeners, we're talking about World War II this hour. We're talking about Paul Fussell's book called The Boys' Crusade. And we're talking about how World War II is depicted in popular culture and how it's remembered by us and by veterans. Do you think America is still in love with the myth of the so-called good war? How do our memories and myths about wars shape our sense of America's current role in the world? You can join our conversation with Paul Fussell by calling 1-800-423-8255. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. I'm Alex Beam, sitting in for Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Our guest this hour is Paul Fussell. He's a World War II veteran. He's a World War II historian, also a literary critic. His new book is called The Boys' Crusade, The American Infantry in Northwestern Europe, 1944 to 1945. You can join our conversation with Paul Fussell by calling 1-800-423-8255. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Talk. We're taking a call from John from Newton, Massachusetts.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hello, John.
How are you doing, sir?
Okay.
I wondered if you look upon the, if you will, prettied up history that Tom Brokaw and others of his generation who were children during that war, and then, in fact, watched the horror of Vietnam and everything out of Vietnam was just so miserable. There didn't seem to be anybody who was really, you know, there were no redeeming features coming out of Vietnam. I'm wondering if, in fact, the glorification of the earlier war was a way, in fact, to kind of put to rest the horrors that individuals and people seem to recognize almost as a societal base of what happened to us during Vietnam.
Yes, I'd agree entirely with that reading of the history of those events. The Second World War had to be cleaned up for public consumption when it was over, and it gradually created this elaborate body of myth that was so important to America's intellectual and emotional well-being, it was thought. And shifting the truth over in the direction of optimism made it go too far in that direction, and therefore there had to be an opposite reaction. And the opposite reaction was the press reaction to the Vietnam War. The Vietnam War was very awful in other respects, and more awful in many ways than the Second World War had been for the ground troops. But Every war is awful, and it's all a matter of either remembering or forgetting, not really a matter of what happened. But thanks for your call.
I wonder if I could ask one additional question.
Yeah.
That is that my understanding was, and I hope this won't bring a whole lot of ugly calls, but my understanding was the American Legion was formed during and following World War One, primarily because of a concern during the war of a possible mutiny by the American soldiers, such as had occurred with the French soldiers during World War One, and after the war, to try to boost up a patriotism, which was, for those who had gone through World War One, just didn't want to go through it again, ever. Mm-hmm. Do you know of that?
No, I don't know of that. I think the second part of what you say is probably more true than the first part. We weren't in that war as soldiers long enough to contrive anything like mutiny. The French had been in it for 4 years. We were in it for about a year and a half, and our troops were there only a few months. And a lot of soldiers who fought were sick of it, but a big movement of mutiny was never a part of it. The American Legion, I think, after the war, was an attempt to, well, I don't know what, to drink a lot of beer, probably, and to have a good time with your fellows. And I think it had no larger and certainly no sinister meaning above that.
John, thank you for calling us. We're going to take a call from Lee, who's joining us from Medford, Massachusetts. How do you do, Lee?
Yeah, hi. Thanks, Mr. Fussell. I just want to say that I think what you're doing is really, really important. So many of these revisionist books coming out, I don't think they serve the country particularly well. I read you. I read John Keegan a lot. My dad's a veteran of World War II, and I haven't read your new book, but everything you've said so far very closely maps to what he describes. He was in infantry. He was lucky. He was field artillery, so they got to ride around. And his unit was the first into the Nordhausen POW camp.
Yes.
And what you're describing is just the truth. One of his worst memories that he's described to me was how the prisoners went for the Nazi guards and how one of them attacked him and was beating him with a rifle butt, stabbing him. And my father said, I couldn't take it. I couldn't bear to see somebody beaten like that. He jumped into the trench he was digging and tried to separate them, but, you know, the other guys in his unit pulled him back and said, let him go. He deserves it. He deserves it. It was just really horrible for him. Also describing the poverty of the civilians, trying to give people food and being told by a sergeant, you can't do that. You've got to eat the stuff. You've got to keep up your strength. My dad doesn't feel that what they did was wrong, but he doesn't glorify it. And actually, he never really spoke of it much until right around 1994. My husband and I took a trip to Normandy during that whole anniversary period. We went there a couple of weeks later, and I tried to persuade him to come with me. I said, hey, Dad, why don't you come? You haven't been back there. He said, I never want to go back there. I have no good memories. I have no good memories. Why would I want to go back? I found talking to a lot of veterans, you know, my friends' dads, most of them served. The ones who saw the most seem to be the ones that speak the least, and I just really respect what you're doing. It may not be popular, but it's really important for people to see the truth. And I think right now there tends to be sort of a gung-ho attitude towards military action on our part. That's my personal politics speaking. But I think if more people realize just what it means, maybe there'd be a little more thoughtfulness. And that's all I have to say.
Thank you,
but
Lee.
Thanks very much, and I look forward to buying your book.
Thank you. I think your last comment really sheds light on why I wrote this book. I wrote this book to indicate that no matter how charming soldiers could be, no matter how well-trained they were, and no matter how nice they were to women and so on, they were still in the business of mass murder. And we must never forget it. We must never use it except for circumstances that are unplayable in any other way.
Paul Fussell, we have an army in the field now, as you know. Can you, in a sense, look into their faces the way I'm looking actually right now at the face of a young infantryman, the face that's on the cover of your book?
Most of them are older than the kids that fought under my leadership, so it's not quite the same. But yeah, go ahead. You had something else.
No, I'm just curious if you think, in a sense, that same kind of sort of the gray reality, not the colorful reality, not perhaps a reality of total darkness. I mean, is what their experience in Iraq is about.
Yeah, I think so. But it should never be forgotten that they're all volunteers. They are volunteers just like members of the United States Marine Corps. And I value those people very highly because they know what they're doing and they know what the rules are and so forth. So nobody's being drafted or being forced to do what he has to do.
We're bringing a volunteer into the conversation, Paul. Tony is calling us from Fort Gordon, Georgia.
Yes, sir. I'd just like to ask you, I'm about to go over to Iraq, and I'm an interrogator with military intelligence.
Good.
And
Can I ask you something?
Yes, sir.
Do you speak Arabic?
Yes, I do.
Good. Okay. Now you can go on.
I just like to know, I don't want to do anything over there that is going to be immoral, and I don't really know if you could give me some advice about how to act over there. I want to be a moral person.
Of course. Now, can you answer this? What's your rank?
I'm a specialist.
Well, are you a T5 or a T4, a sergeant, or are you a commissioned officer?
No, I'm not. I'm equivalent to a corporal.
Yeah. Okay. Well, what can I say? I think your point is to obey orders, and if the orders strike you as outrageous and immoral, to say so. I think nothing will happen to you if you do that, because the Army has become much more civilized than it was when I was in it. So I think they're quite prepared to listen and understand soldiers' complaints about having to do actions which they regard as immoral.
Tony, when are you scheduled to go over there?
About 2 weeks.
I see.
Let me wish you good luck.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for calling. What are Paul Fussell? I mean, I was in the last age eligible class of potential draftees. How does this? You seem happy, or am I mishearing you about the notion that the men and women in today's Army are volunteers and want to be there?
Well, I'm happy about it because it means that we don't, up to now, require a draft, which creates appalling problems. If people in the Army feel that some sort of injustice has been done, their families who have had to stay home, largely without much income or much attention, I think it's important to realize that the soldiers chose that line of work. And they knew what was going to happen. They hoped it wouldn't happen, but it was always a possibility. And the same is for people in the reserve and in the National Guard and so on, who may have enlisted or joined those volunteer organizations, hoping simply to pick up a weekly or a monthly check for doing nothing, who found that they now find that they can legally be called up and sent off perhaps to be killed. Well, they should have known that from the start. I don't have much sympathy for them.
You use, of course, the title of your book, Paul, is a crusade. And we talked earlier about even before American soldiers saw the death camps, they were certainly aware of the kind of civilization, so-called, that Adolf Hitler was running. What if you had to speculate, put yourself in the shoes of a soldier today? What moral purpose do you think our current Army might be imbued with?
That is very hard for me to answer because it seems that the whole – I didn't want to get into this subject, but the whole current military operation seems to me utterly unjustified by diplomacy and by international norms. And it's well to remember that there's a term for it now. Conducting a war because you think the enemy might arise and do something to you.
Preemption?
preemptive. The whole idea of preemptive war, you know, up to this point, actually, was in the hands of two tyrants. One was Stalin and the other was Hitler. And when they attacked each other and when they attacked other people, they always had a preemptive reason for it, which they forced their people to swallow. And for that reason, I'm not a real fan of the present war. And don't ask me what alternative I would have proposed, because I don't have one. But it's still a war, and it's still very nasty, and there has to be a cause which in 50 years will look justified. I don't think there is one.
You know, we've reading your work, when you write about World War II, you draw the distinction between a good war and a necessary war. I know you, I mean, the good war is not your phrase, but you have written about World War II as a necessary war. Do you think we're currently engaged in such a conflict, a necessary conflict?
No, I do not. No, I believe that term does apply to the war against the Nazis. They were sinking our ships all over the Atlantic Ocean, wherever they could reach them. They were murdering people for no reason at all, except ideologically or religiously, something like that. And I think that cause was justified and was therefore necessary. Sometimes people ask me, I've written a book called Thank God for the Atom Bomb, which begins with a justification or an attempted justification for the dropping of the atom bomb and ending thereby the Japanese war. And when people ask me if they thought the war, if they thought that was a good thing, I say no, but it was a necessary thing. And some things are necessary that are not good things.
Paul, we're going to let's just end the hour with those words, because
they make
a great deal of sense. Thank you for your time. Thanks to my guest this hour. That was Paul Fussell, World War II historian and book critic. The most recent book he's written is called The Boys' Crusade, The American Infantry in Northwestern Europe, 1944 to 1945. If you want to learn more about our conversation and find relevant internet links, you can visit our website, www.theconnection.org. The Connection's produced by Khalil Bird, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Orit Kurutsky-Fox, Jen Mattson, Christina Russo, and Doug Shugerts. Our interns are Jennifer Giles and Sarah Ligon. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Alex Beam, sitting in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.